Today on the Florida Roundup, a team of local reporters uncovers how Florida ignited the country's heroin epidemic. Hello, I'm Christine DiMattei, filling in for Tom Hudson this week. A recent Palm Beach Post investigation looks at the so-called Oxy Express and how Florida's repeated failure to control its own prescription drug problem would eventually lead to more addicts turning to heroin. We'll also be discussing the deadly protests in Nicaragua and the deepening political and humanitarian crisis there. Plus, invasive iguanas are all but taking over South Florida. We hear from listeners and wildlife experts about why these mini dinosaurs are nowhere near extinction. Join us with a panel of the area's top journalists. We'll also be getting your input along the way. The Florida Roundup is next. Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Christine DiMattei, filling in for Tom Hudson. Before we begin, we at WLRN would like to extend our heartfelt sympathies to the staff of the Capital Gazette in Annapolis, to the families and friends of the victims of yesterday's awful shooting. You've probably heard by now that among those killed was Rob Hiasen. He was the brother of novelist and Miami Herald columnist Carl Hiasen. Now, the staff of the Capital Gazette temporarily at least put aside their grief and actually went to print this morning. The courage of that whole staff in the face of this tragedy is an example to us all. But now onward. For news outlets large and small, many times the most in-depth, probing, questing news story is sparked by a simple question, like this one. Did a crackdown designed to stop a drug crisis in Florida set off a much worse drug epidemic in other U.S. states? Joining us from Boynton Beach is Palm Beach Post reporter Pat Beal, who led a team of investigative journalists looking into Florida's role in triggering a nationwide heroin epidemic. Pat, it's great to have you back again.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Pat, to connect the dots, you and your team traveled what's become known as the Oxy Express. What is that and where is it exactly?
Well, the Oxy Express was the nickname given to a stretch of roadways from South Florida, specifically Palm Beach and Broward County, all through the Appalachians. And it was an area where people would come down, drive down, van loads of people, load up on drugs here in Palm Beach County through our pill mills, and then drive back to the Appalachians and sell or use the same drugs.
Now, in beginning the story, in beginning the series, your entire series of reporting, there were plenty of people along the way who told you flatly that this story is unprovable. Epidemiologists, particularly, who were among those that said that available data alone could never definitively prove this oxycodone to heroin transition, much less Florida's role in this. So what was the first tip you got that launched this whole thing, and what was your reaction to that tip?
Well, I really wasn't paying attention. I think that pretty much sums it up. It was in 2012, early 2012, and I had been doing a story about online drug sales. And in speaking to a couple of treatment counselors locally in Palm Beach County, I was told, listen, the crackdown on prescription pills and pill mills isn't driving people to online drug sales. It's driving them to heroin. Yeah, I really couldn't buy that. I couldn't buy it because I think I had at that time something of the same skewed perception that people had about who a heroin user would be, and why would anybody who was using pills jump to a street drug? So it took a little time for me to wrap my head around that.
Let's go back to the pill mill crisis. You've traced the beginnings of this problem to the rogue pain management clinics in Florida. Back when the pill mills were a thriving business in South Florida, how did they get the prescription meds in the first place?
Well, you know, Florida failed to regulate pill mills, and it really went back many, many years. I mean, there was a problem in Florida that was pretty obvious starting in 2002, 2003 with prescription pills, and basically Florida just did nothing. You know, other states adopted prescription monitoring programs, other states cracked down on their own pill mill activity and rogue doctors, and we just didn't. And so that allowed not only pill mills to thrive and illicit opioids to be transported across state lines, it also provided this incredible window of time that gave, you know, addiction time to kind of take root and grow. And, that was the long and short of it. We just weren't paying attention.
We'd very much like our listeners to join our discussion. Our call-in line is 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Pat, many of the addicted people or former addicts that you interviewed for this series, among them quite a few who say they got their start with Florida oxycodone. A young man named Will was among them. He said that people drove by the van load to go doctor shopping here in South Florida. They arrived back in their home states with hundreds of pills to sell. When Florida cut off the flow of Oxy, Detroit drug dealers moved in.
The big talk was, OxyContin was going off the market. And the fear in everyone that was involved in that, it was crazy. I can remember the day that we stopped seeing them. And the very next day, heroin showed up.
He said the very next day, heroin showed up. That's horrifying. Pat, you've reported that largely because people like El Chapo, drug lord El Chapo, were just biding their time waiting for that sort of opportunity. Now, what proof do you have of that?
Well, we talked with Jack Riley, who was the special agent in charge of capturing El Chapo. And it was pretty clear that, first of all, let me back up a little bit. You know, sometimes we think of these cartels as thugs. In fact, Sinaloa Cartel was a massive corporation with what Jack Riley described as a really good research and development arm. And so it wasn't too big a jump, you know, to understand that an appetite for opioids, prescription opioids, could translate very easily to an appetite for heroin. And in fact, the DEA had put that in writing as early as 2002. So, it wasn't much of a leap.
And also, when we think of drug cartels, we think of a lot of violence, submachine guns, etc. Are you suggesting that a number of these cartels actually have business plans?
Oh, yeah. Everyone who I've ever spoken to has said these larger cartels, and I'm going to focus on Sinaloa a little bit because it was very large, it was very well organized, and it's run with the ruthless efficiency of, a Fortune 500 company. In fact, one epidemiologist talked about how the Colombian cartels, when the dollar fell, they started selling their cocaine in Europe to take advantage of the currency changes and then came back to the U.S. when the currency changed again. They're very sophisticated operations, but yes, they also do. They are murderous.
Now, Pat, I remember back in 2011 when local leaders, everybody was, lawmakers in Tallahassee were actually congratulating themselves for, cracking down on the pill mills here. It was a wonderful thing. But you've said that lawmakers in Tallahassee saw this current problem that you reported about. They saw it coming. And you've been quoted as saying, we really did have the solution in our hands as early as 2002. What solution do you mean? What do you mean by that?
Well, in 2001, then Florida Attorney General Bob Butterworth struck a deal with Purdue Pharma, the maker of OxyContin. And the deal was that Purdue would pay for establishing a prescription drug monitoring database, which was literally a silver bullet to curbing doctor shopping and identifying rogue doctors and pill mills. And all the Florida legislature had to do was pass a bill saying, yes, we will create a prescription drug monitoring database. But it was more than just a database for Florida. There was an opportunity there, and the idea was that Florida would provide the same database structure to every other state in the union. We were going to be a leader, but the bill didn't pass until 2009. And even when it passed in 2009, there was no state money behind it. So it never actually got up and running until about the fourth quarter of 2011.
And another takeaway, when Governor Rick Scott considered stopping the drug monitoring database in 2011, which let's be clear about what exactly it does. It curbs doctor shopping for opioids by tracking prescriptions for the drugs, right?
Yes, it tracks prescriptions, but the data is also available to law enforcement as well under certain circumstances. And there's no doubt that prescription drug monitoring databases work. They worked for other states long before, you know, Florida instituted ours. And there's every reason to believe that ours worked better than anybody could have ever expected.
So when that happened, when Governor Rick Scott considered stopping that drug monitoring database, evidently, Pat, the state of Kentucky went berserk. Why was that?
Well, at one point, a congressman estimated that 60% of all of the illicit oxycodone that was in Kentucky was coming from Florida. And, you know, Kentucky was one of these key states along the Oxy Express Trail. They were dramatically impacted by Florida oxycodone, and they knew where it was coming from, and they had begged Florida to do something for a very long time, and we hadn't. And the idea that this database that was still in the idea stage, pretty much, would be ended. I think for some people, that was just the last straw. And it wasn't just Kentucky. There were, I believe, four U.S. senators who wrote a letter, asking that Governor Scott change his mind, stating specifically, look, this isn't just a Florida problem. This is a massive problem that goes across state lines.
And holding on the line, we have got Emerson from West Palm Beach who's got a question. Emerson, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Good afternoon. A little bit of a question. Clearly the state is taking measures to see that the crisis with the pill mill gave way to the opiate epidemic, which is now being further continued by, you know, the introduction of fentanyl and carfentanyl. My question is, like, you know, other than putting programs in place that will assure that there's close monitoring of those prescription drugs, like, you know, what else is the state intending to do in order to make the public more aware of the fact that, you know, that sort of maturation from the use of prescription drugs to street drugs is, in one sense, inevitable. In another sense, it's facilitated by the overprescribing and just the lack of overall awareness that's where a problem can start.
Right. Thank you, Emerson, for your question. Pat, I think what Emerson is asking here is, you know, what is the state of Florida going to do about this link between the two? And in order for anything to happen, I mean, the state of Florida has to recognize that there's a link between the two.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. I think, you know, it's the awareness of what addiction is and the mechanics of addiction. And, one of the things that Jack Riley also said is that cartels understand addiction. And it, for all appearances, it appeared that the cartels understood addiction better than state lawmakers. And I think the question is absolutely on point. What is the state going to do? And will the state's policy decisions be driven by science or evidence about the nature of addiction? You know, Florida does lag pretty badly behind other states in terms of treatment options, and we talk about that a little bit, too, in our project.
And finally, Pat, before we leave you, of all the stories that you gathered along the way and you saw a lot of misery, which is the one that's going to stay with you for a while?
Oh, gosh. That's a good question. I think it is the scenario of Bob Butterworth and Purdue Pharma hammering out this kind of deal and looking at what happened as the years passed. And you have to ask yourself, if we had had that back in 2002, maybe we still would have had an opioid epidemic, but I'm not sure what it would have looked like. And it's an unanswered question, but I think it's an important question to ask.
on our website, WLRN.org. We will shortly provide a link to the Palm Beach Post's investigative report titled How Florida Ignited the Heroin Epidemic. But in the meantime, you can find it at heroin.palmbeachpost.com. It is a must-read series courtesy of Pat Beal and a talented team of journalists at the Palm Beach Post. Pat, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
We need to take a quick break. Just ahead, the deepening political and humanitarian crisis in Nicaragua. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Christine DiMatte. Now, before we resume our discussion, we just want to remind you that we would very much like you to be an active part of this conversation. So please, let's hear your comments and questions. The number to call is 800-743-WLRN. Once again, that's 800-743-9576. You can also tweet us at WLRN. Earlier in the week, Felix Maradiaga left Miami and went back to his homeland, Nicaragua. A courageous move, considering that he is a wanted man there. Nicaragua President Daniel Ortega wants Maradiaga arrested for inciting protests against Ortega's regime.
The situation is much, much worse than we expected. So I wanted to start working as soon as possible in joining my colleagues to find a solution.
Maradiaga is a leading human rights activist. He heads the Institute for Strategic Studies and Public Policy in Managua. He said he plans to organize a new wave of nonviolent protests to force Ortega out of power. Now, nearly 3 months after deadly protests in Nicaragua, they showed no signs of letting up. Police and members of a pro-government militia have been attacking protesters, demanding the resignation of the socialist leader who's ruled that country for much of the last 40 years. The death toll has risen to at least 285 people, with countless others wounded and dozens missing.
We see a government that is using extreme violence precisely because they're weak, precisely because they're losing legitimacy.
Now, the audio there was a little hard to make out, I think. So what Mr. Maradiaga just said was, we see a government that is using extreme violence precisely because they're weak, precisely because they're losing legitimacy. With us in the studio is WLRN America's correspondent Tim Padgett. Tim, always a pleasure.
Thank you.
And joining us from the Miami Herald newsroom in Doral is Herald columnist Glenn Garvin. Throughout his career, he's reported extensively from and about Nicaragua, and this includes his book titled Everybody Had His Own Gringo, The CIA and the Contras, and offers an account of the Nicaraguan Civil War. Glenn, it's wonderful to have you on.
Hi, thanks. Good to be here.
Tim, first off, you were in touch with Felix Maradiaga earlier this week. Mm-hmm. Since his return to Managua, do we have any news of him?
As far as we know, he has not been arrested yet. That was one of the big fears of his return to Nicaragua, since, as you point out, he's a wanted man there. Ortega has been sort of filing all these trumped-up charges against him, accusing him of some part of an international conspiracy to incite the violence inside Nicaragua. In fact, he's tacitly blaming Maradiaga for the deaths of these anti-government protesters. And Maradiaga is essentially looking at 30 years in prison if he is arrested and prosecuted.
30 years. Glenn, please give us a little snapshot of how this current crisis began. Who are the people protesting against Ortega? What do they want? The people who support him, what do they want?
Well, this has been led largely, not entirely, but largely by college students. Now, they have a lot of backing among the business classes, the wealthy, but those are not the people out on the front lines, and they're not the people who are running the show. It's the kids. It began in mid-April when the students thought the government was slow to contain a forest fire in a nature conservancy in Nicaragua. But I think, honestly, that was more like an excuse for the expression of a lot of pent-up frustration with Daniel Ortega's government. Then there was an acceleration of this when the government announced it was going to cut Social Security payments to the elderly. And then since then, it's just been everything. The violence has fed itself, of course. The more kids who get killed, the angrier the rest of the kids become.
Now, has the situation with Social Security there reached situation critical?
No, I don't think so. Ortega actually backed down on that particular thing within a couple of weeks. And honestly, the cuts, though they would have been very uncomfortable for elderly people in a poor country, they were not of catastrophic levels. They would have been uncomfortable. They would have been painful. There would not have been people starving on the streets. I think really this is long time frustration with a government that is unashamedly undemocratic, and people have gotten fed up with it.
Tim, why is Ortega so stubbornly averse to giving up power?
Well, the thing you have to understand about Daniel Ortega is his holding power and not giving it up has everything to do with revenge, really, for what happened to him in 1990. You'll remember that he led the Sandinista front, the guerrillas, that toppled the right-wing dictator Anastasio Somoza back in 1979. For all of the 1980s, Ortega was essentially the Marxist dictator in Nicaragua, and that is what precipitated the Contra War that Glenn writes about in his book, and prompted the United States to pressure Ortega to hold a democratic election in 1990, which he lost. And he has never forgiven himself, really, for allowing himself to relinquish power. I interviewed him a few months after that election, and it was obvious that what he really regretted wasn't the fact that he had trashed his country's economy and brought it into civil war. What he really regretted was that he had stupidly allowed himself to give up power, which is very important to anyone who feels that he is the dictator of the proletariat, et cetera, et cetera. So when he was elected again in 2006, it was obvious that he had already decided he was never going to let what happened to him in 1990 happen again.
I think it's important to add here, he was elected in 2006, and it was fair and square.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But he did not have a majority of the vote. He won with, I think, about 35%, between 35% and 40%.
Mm-hmm.
He sort of manipulated, legally and fairly, playing to their egos, he manipulated the opposition into putting up two candidates instead of uniting behind one. And as a result, 40%, was enough to win the election. But he has never been the majority leader of Nicaragua. And that's really coming home to roost.
And yeah. I would add just real quickly to what Glenn's saying, that he duped everyone in 2006 into thinking that this was the new Daniel Ortega. He was going to be more moderate, that he was going to be more pro-business, and to a certain extent he was, but he forgot to tell everybody that he was going to set up essentially a dictatorship.
And for how many people was his putting his wife in power the tipping point here?
A lot. She has really been seen as he's sort of gone into this sort of mumbling stage where he's really not seen that much, and there's this perception that she's really sort of the power behind the throne these days, and the fact that he made her vice president in the last election, that just really hasn't sat well with Nicaraguans or people outside of Nicaragua.
I should add that that's true also of Ortega's own supporters in large degree. As one guy told me when I was in Managua a few weeks ago, listen, we all marched into Managua behind Daniel in 1979. None of us ever marched behind Rosario Murillo anywhere.
Yeah. And what also really angers a lot of these anti-government protesters is that many of them are the grandchildren of people who fought alongside Ortega to topple Somoza back in 1979. Felix Maradiaga, for example, his father was a political prisoner under the Somoza regime.
Glenn, you've interviewed a retired U.S. diplomat, Robert Callahan, and he served in three Central American countries. And he said of Ortega, quote, he's never had popular support. So how could he be in office so long without popular support? Explain that to us.
Well, I think Callahan was referring to the same thing I mentioned a little while ago. It's not that Ortega has no support. Nobody should think that. He's always had this 35% to 40%. But because it used to be in Nicaragua that if nobody got 50% of the vote in the first round, then you had a runoff between the top two candidates. And mathematically, somebody is going to finish with more than 50% in that situation. Ortega kind of politically fooled the former president of Nicaragua. Help me out here, Tim. My brain just went flat.
Locked up.
Oh,
Alemán.
Alemán, Arnaldo Alemán. Right.
He tricked Alemán. I mean, you know, legally, but he tricked him into signing an agreement to amend the Constitution that that included so-called first-past-the-post election. That is, whatever candidate gets the most votes in the first round of voting, as long as they get at least 35%, they're president, even though, of course, they don't have a majority. I think that's what Callahan was referring to. And until now, nobody has... You know, there's been grumbling about Ortega for a long time. He kind of defused some of the opposition among the business class by leaving them alone. You didn't have any of the things like confiscations and wage price guidelines that you had when Ortega was president in the 90s. So they were restrained in their criticism. They didn't like him, but they kind of sat back.
And we have a question coming in from North Miami. We have a question from Tangem. Tangem.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. So just a real quick bit of background. My family's from Bangladesh, which back in the 70s went through an unusually similar situation. We had student uprisings, the civil war that split us off from Pakistan at the time. At the same time, the U.S. Kind of played let's call it a standoffish role. If you remember, Kissinger kind of denied the genocide at the time that was going on. And so I'm kind of curious, how do you think we as the United States should or will respond in the case that the situation in Nicaragua continues to escalate?
And that was going to be my next question. Thank you, Tangem. Glenn, what has been the worldwide response to the unrest and the deadly protests?
Well, honestly, when you're talking about Nicaragua, the country whose opinion always, for better or for worse, counts the most is the United States. The U.S. government has really stayed out of this. There have been winks and nods that there may be a little bit with the protests, but they have not intervened in any meaningful way. Latin America has mostly stayed out of it, too. There was, I think, a mildly critical resolution at the last OAS meeting, but essentially nothing. And frankly, this is when you talk to the protesters, they say this is what's going to make or break them. Ortega has the army. Ortega has the police. Ortega has all the mechanics of the government at his disposal.
And that's why we've been seeing so many of these student protesters, for example, visiting Miami recently. They're
right.
Trying to drum up more support here to get the expat community to start assisting them in this effort. It's why one of the reasons Maradiaga, for example, came
but
here.
But assisting how? What can the diaspora here do?
Two ways. To get supplies, for example, into a lot of these kids are getting, you know, shot on the front lines, and they don't, a lot of times they don't have, you know, medicines and bandages and things like that. I think one of the more important ways, though, is to start lobbying, in particular, South Florida Congress people up in Washington to get them more enthused about this. I mean, one of the big problems is that the United States right now is spending so much of its political and diplomatic capital in Latin America on Venezuela, and that's making it difficult to sort of pivot and throw some of that into Nicaragua.
And Tim, much has been said about the fact that for all its problems, Nicaragua was starting to enjoy some quote-unquote economic stability. And
yeah.
This has always confused me. It's still one of the poorest nations in the hemisphere, I think, mm-hmm. Second after Haiti, right? So what are we talking about when we say economic stability? What are the backbones of this country's economy,
well,
first
that's
off?
One of the big reasons why this unrest really didn't manifest itself until this year. There was this feeling, not only that Nicaragua was enjoying a certain amount of economic stability, but also security stability. You look at the Northern Triangle of Central America, it's beleaguered right now by narco violence. A lot of that has just not been seen in Nicaragua. And the business community, as Glenn aptly pointed out before, has been very content. But there just came a point where even the business community began to see, oh my God, what a price we have paid for Daniel letting us make money. He has essentially destroyed the democratic institutions in this country, whether it's the judiciary or the legislature. He essentially has all of his Sandinista buddies on the Supreme Court who trashed the Constitution to let him keep running for president indefinitely. So even the business community now has begun to realize that they paid too large a price for being able to, make profits.
So he flouted democratic norms, but he delivered on the economic promises.
Right, and that's exactly how, as I said before, how he got elected. He really charmed the business community into thinking this is the new Daniel, and that lasted for a while until they finally woke up and realized, wait a minute, this is an authoritarian government that we've sort of let emerge here.
Glenn Garvin, what about the Catholic Church in Nicaragua? How strong?
Well, the church as an institution is hugely strong and popular. The vast majority of Nicaraguans are Catholics. The church has made its opposition clear, although it's been restrained in the expression of that opposition. But they've made statements in support of the students. They were supposed to mediate talks between the students and the government. That didn't go anywhere and collapsed fast. But I think it's pretty clear which side they're on, and it's not Ortega's.
And finally, Tim and Glenn, whichever one of you want to take this, or both of you, what will it take for this to end? What does each side have to give up to get peace in Nicaragua?
I think, unfortunately, it's going to take a lot more people getting killed, and that would probably add pressure then on Ortega to concede to things like early elections, which is one of the things these protesters are calling for.
I agree with it. But I really think Nicaragua is in for some difficult times. I just don't see any evidence that Ortega is willing to step down, and yeah. I don't see any evidence that the students will accept anything less than that.
Unfortunately, I agree.
We've been talking to WLRN America's correspondent Tim Padgett. Tim, thank you.
Thank you.
Also, Miami Herald columnist Glenn Garvin, who has devoted much of an illustrious career reporting about Nicaragua. Glenn, thank you.
Hey, thanks for inviting me.
We're going to take a short break. Still to come, the invasive species here in South Florida that's giving Burmese pythons and lionfish a run for their money. We're talking about those pesky iguanas. We're going to want your iguana stories, so here's the number to call, 800-743-9576. We will be right back. I'm Christine DiMatte. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. In South Florida, they are out of control. Experts dealing with iguana removal say that this year might actually set records in the number of invasive reptiles creeping around Broward, Miami-Dade, Palm Beach, and Monroe counties. What's more, they say there's no real way to get a firm estimate of the exact number of invasive iguanas there are in South Florida, but they suspect the number is gigantic.
Welcome to Jurassic Park.
Okay. Very funny. With us via Skype is Sun Sentinel reporter Doreen Christensen, who co-wrote a recent report about the extent of South Florida's iguana problem. Doreen, it's great to have you on. Do we have Doreen?
Thank you so much for having me on, Christine.
And also joining us by phone is...
I'm here. Can you hear me?
We can hear you. Okay, we're having a little trouble connecting with Doreen, but also joining us by phone is Joe Wazalewski. He's a conservation biologist and president of Natural Selections of South Florida, an environmental consulting firm. Joe, welcome.
Thank you.
Last but not least, here in the studio with us is Katie Lepre. She's just chomping at the bit here. Is it chomping or champing? I think it's champing, isn't it?
You know, Chris, I'm not actually sure.
Well, when we talk about these iguanas, we're going to be talking about a lot of chomping and champing. She is WLRN's social engagement producer, and we actually reached out to our listeners days ago for their comments and their observations on the great iguana invasion. And the response was pretty overwhelming, wasn't it, Katie?
It was indeed. I'm super excited to talk about some of the stories we heard.
And we've got people on the, you know, the anti-iguana front who's saying, you know, what is it going to take to get rid of these nasty things? But we also have people who think they're kind of cool. And our phone lines are still open for anyone who's got an iguana story. The number to call is 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. And you can always tweet us at WLRN. Joe, my first question is for you. Personally, there are two types of iguanas that I'm running into all the time. One is a long, thin, solid lime green colored reptile that's, you know, actually kind of pretty. And the other one, not so much. It looks like a smaller version of the Komodo dragon that co-starred in the 1980s movie The Freshman. You know what I'm talking about.
Right, I know what you're talking about, but let me preface all this by saying nobody loves iguanas more than I do. let me just start by that, and the first one you mentioned is the common green iguana, native to Central and South America, and they range in color from bright lime green, dark green, almost black, to orange. The males get orange in the breeding season. The second iguana is called a spiny-tailed iguana, and it's from Mexico and Central America.
Okay, but both of them are invasive, right? Neither of them belongs here.
Correct. Yeah, they're exotic invasive species. Absolutely.
So, Joe, why is there no way to get a firm estimate of the exact number of invasive iguanas there are in South Florida?
Let me just put it this way. The resources for the governing agencies over the past 10, 15 years have been put in other areas, like, for instance, the Burmese python. And since the iguanas are more vegetarian and less likely to get 18 feet long, less funding and effort was spent on them. And what happened in the interim is they're population literally exploded, and it's really extremely difficult to get population numbers, except to say they're very common.
Okay, and we've asked people for their iguana stories, and actually the phones are ringing off the hook, as you can imagine. On the line we've got Julio from North Miami.
Hi, how are you?
Julio, welcome to the show. What's your story?
Hi, thank you. Well, it's funny you bring this up about the iguanas. In the past 3 or 4 weeks, my outdoor cat has been bringing iguanas, dead iguanas.
Has been bringing you iguanas. Now, Julio, these iguanas are pretty big. I wonder at the size of your cat.
Ew, my cat is actually pretty tiny, but she is surprisingly good at hunting things. And these beautiful green iguanas are the ones that she seems to catch most.
You know, Julio, you're actually not the only one who has a pet chasing out iguanas. We heard from one of our listeners, Carolyn M. in Margate, who said that she has dozens of iguanas that come through her backyard, and her chihuahuas actually chase them back out through the fence to the canal, and occasionally a fat one gets stuck back there and has to be helped. So we've also heard from other listeners, someone from Riviera Beach actually texted us, and she said that iguanas aren't an issue for her. I'm curious, Joe, you know, Chris was just asking you about, you know, getting a firm estimate of the exact number.
Right.
Are these invasive iguanas more common in certain parts of South Florida, or are they just omnipresent in the entire region?
Joe Wasilewski, you with us?
I haven't done anything. Yep, I'm here.
So, Joe, I wanted to know if the invasive iguanas are more common in certain parts of South Florida, maybe in Broward or in Palm Beach, or if they're just everywhere in the entire region.
The answer to that is yes and no. They're pretty much everywhere. However, they have their particular habitat preference. that is along canals. They like golf courses. They like big open areas with aquatic features nearby and like hammocks, like little forests to hide in.
Mm-hmm.
So those type of habitats will have plenty of them.
Okay, and I think we have Doreen Christensen of the Sun Sentinel back. Doreen, you with us? Okay, evidently not. We're going to take a call here. This is Walter from Miami Shores. The question is, do they taste like chicken, I guess? Walter from Miami Shores, what do you want to know about these here iguanas?
When there are certain animals that have been overhunted and just extinction, like the rhino and whatever, that, but when people start to eat animals, like in Central America, Puerto Rico and other countries, they eat iguanas. They eat iguana eggs. I mean, why not? Why don't we turn them into a commodity? And I eat an iguana, sure. You know,
okay.
Maybe the pythons, too. We can put them on a plate, too.
Okay, I'm going to throw that question to Joe Wasilewski. Joe, are they edible?
Yes, they are edible. And, in fact, in Central America, they call them the chicken of the trees. They're farmed in Nicaragua, El Salvador, and a couple other countries, Colombia, South America. And in Puerto Rico, you could purchase it, but it's quite pricey. It's like $20 a pound or something. But yes, I've never eaten them, but yes, they are a favorite food for some people.
I can tell you at least one of our listeners has actually eaten an iguana. A woman named Shelley in Delray Beach texted us that, yeah, iguanas are horrible. And a couple nights ago, one of her coworkers hit one on her scooter on her way home from work. Then she grilled it and brought it in for everyone to eat. So,
okay. And I think, finally, we've got Doreen Christensen of
yes.
the Sun Sentinel. Doreen, sorry to have lost
here.
You.
I don't know why we're having so many audio issues today, but maybe the iguanas are chewing through the radio wave.
Which
this was
going to be my next question, is you have interviewed at least one of these managers of those iguana control companies. And, you know, iguanas, in addition to, you know, burrowing into backyards and eating indigenous plants, you know, they're messing up our air conditioning and our lighting. So what's going on with that?
Well, my colleague and I, Ellie Rushing, reported last week that they actually cause power outages. So the iguanas climb up the poles and they actually touch the wires and, you know, zap, and the transformer gets blown. And the next thing you know, you're sitting there sweltering in the heat. You've got a barbecued iguana sitting there, you know, ready to chow down on, as your last caller called in on. And FPL has to come and actually repair the transformer. And FPL told me that they had about 9,000 outages. And a lot of these happen in South Florida because obviously we're overrun with them. But I always also wanted to mention, Christine, this is funny. We just put a story up on our website about how to eat iguanas, chicken of the trees. And there's even a recipe for burritos.
And in a few seconds, we're going to get to, well, you know, not in a few seconds. Let's get to it now, Joe and Doreen. How does one, according to Florida law, humanely dispatch these animals?
Well, in our research and in talking to in stories we've written, bashing them on the head is the most humane way to kill them. I know a lot of people wouldn't think that is a humane thing, but it's instantaneous. Poisoning and drowning, those types of things are considered very inhumane, and you should not ever do that.
Okay, so Joe Wasilewski, according to Florida law, you may not poison them. There's a particular way that you have to dispatch them.
Well, I've done a lot of research on that particular subject, and the only acceptable method from the American Veterinary Medical Association and the Zoo Keepers Association is chemical means, not poisoning, but injecting them with a particular chemical or blunt head trauma. And as Doreen said, that's, you know, kind of taking, you know, hitting their head with a blunt object. And let me put it this way. There's no humane way to kill any living creature.
Correct.
I kind of like to say that. However, I've seen an iguana in 100% perfect shape, and in less than 1 second later, it's an inanimate object that's dead without feeling any pain whatsoever. So I've seen it, I've witnessed it, and I'll stand by what Doreen said.
Okay, and as we continue our discussion, maybe I should have this disclaimer in now that our discussion is probably going to include descriptions of how these iguanas are killed, so that maybe some listeners may find disturbing. Okay, we said earlier that I got to tell you, Katie Lepre, never in my experience on the Florida Roundup have the phones lit up like this. People have very, very strong reactions, very strong emotions about these reptiles.
They do indeed, Chris.
And you know, there was one Instagram post that you and I actually tussled over. Okay, but I'm going to read it. I'm going to read it. This is Sally from Key West. She sent us this message on Instagram. Ready? One pooped in my coffee when I was sitting outside enjoying my idyllic Key West morning. Same iguana also fell out of the tree right next to me in the same spot where I have my morning coffee. I'm ready to call the tree trimmer to trim the tree and back because I'm afraid to sit outside in my favorite spot now.
We also got a text message from Lisa, who says she lives in a beautiful condo in Deerfield Beach. She says she has so many bad iguana experiences that it was hard for her to narrow it down to one to tell us. So here's one of them. She said she's had them fight above her in banyan trees, only to have the loser fall down next to me. And of course she wanted to add one more. She said she went for a run, and had a black, rotting, dead iguana, the body parts of this dead iguana falling on me from trees. She says she's just gotten so used to them now.
Used to them. They're all over the place. We've got Sharon on the phone from Miami. Sharon, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate it. I really have a strange story. I had taken my college granddaughters for lunch over at Rusty Pelican. And we sat outside, and the next thing we know, a parade of iguanas come out of the bay, you know, through their lovely bushes. Well, it was interesting to watch them. The next thing I know, they're on the ledge right beside our table. And wouldn't you know, one, two, three, two of them jumped onto the table and were eating our appetizers. Of course, the girl screamed, so did I. And a man came by with a towel to try to distract them. It was humorously scary. That's all I can say.
Sharon, they jumped on your table where you were dining?
Yes, they jumped on the... There was a ledge beside the table outdoors. And
okay.
So they were walking along the ledge, and the next thing you know, they had jumped on our table and were eating whatever the appetizer still was.
They're getting bolder. Sharon, thank you for your story. We're going to go back to Doreen Christensen of the Sun Sentinel. Doreen, does that surprise you? I mean, they're not usually...
No, it doesn't surprise me because as I stand here, I'm looking out my back window in Oakland Park, and there's probably 20 of them basking lazily on the seawall, congregating, which is like what led me to start exploring this to begin with, because I've lived here for, you know, I'm just about a native, and I've lived here for a long time. I've never seen this many iguanas. You know, that caused us to start looking into the situation, and sure enough, some of the trappers and the people that I talked to, like the gentleman that runs the company Iguana Control, told me in the 9 years he's been doing this, this is the most iguanas he's ever seen.
Okay, now.
And they literally are out of control. And the one thing I will too say that we wrote about in our story, which, by the way, we have an iguana's headquarters if you want to see all the stuff and learn about how to legally exterminate iguanas and other things and get iguana recipes, go to sunsentinel.com/iguana. But one of the things that he mentioned to me was that, and other wildlife experts, these invasive species crowd out native species. And native species and plants are very important to the ecosystem of Florida. So meanwhile, these creatures are eating all the plants. They're eating, you know, and some of the natural wildlife suffers. And about 45% of the species that are on the endangered species list are attributable to these invasive species.
And Doreen, we're gonna come back to the environmental threat in just a second. I'm going to take a call from Mary Lake Worth. Mary from Mary, welcome to the show. What's your iguana story?
Well, just last week, my golden retriever retrieved a smaller iguana, and brought him into the living room. And the next thing I know, this iguana is, you know, standing up on his hind legs. I tried to get him with a towel, and he was standing on his hind legs with his little front arms, like this, like, you know, flailing around.
Well, he was
after me down the hallway.
What he was chasing you down, Mary, in your own house?
Yes. Oh, man. I have a towel, and I like shut the doors because I didn't want him to get underneath the bed, or like screaming.
Okay, I got to tell you, Mary, where was your blasted dog? I mean, you're supposed to sick your dog on him, if that's the case.
Oh no, he just brought him to me. After that, it's all over.
Oh, terrific! Yeah, sure, he leaves you alone with the blasted thing.
Yeah, and it was so funny because my fiance Jim, he says to me, "Honey, you're on your own on this one." I couldn't believe it.
Mary, thank you for the call. Unreal. So, I mean, I don't know, Katie Lepre.
I don't know either. I have my own story, but that's for a different time and a different place, Chris.
What are they more of? A serious environmental threat or pesky nuisance? You can always tweet us at WLRN. We've been talking to Sun Sentinel reporter Doreen Christensen and Joe Wasilewski, conservation biologist. That's all the time we have for today's Florida Roundup. The show is produced by Bridget O'Brien. Our engagement producer is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontado is our digital director. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Peter J. Maris. Our technical supervisor is Jason Zapka. I'm Christine DiMatte. Thanks for joining us today.